We're learning about what paradoxical lucidity is in the latest research on dementia. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So sometimes there's a surprising, coherent episode of meaningful communication right before death, and scientists used to label it terminal lucidity. Now there's new funding in the pipeline to examine what happens more broadly as someone who was incapable of interaction is suddenly present and aware of the people in their life. Do you have a loved one with dementia who has experienced sudden moments of clarity, like recognizing family members? What happened? What was it like for you? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Basil Eldada is a supervisory medical officer of the Division of Geriatrics and Clinical Gerontology at the National Institute on Aging. Dr. Eldada, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So tell us more about this phenomenon, this paradoxical lucidity. Where are you going with it?
Yeah, so paradoxical lucidity, as you mentioned, is this unexpected return of mental clarity in someone who's been non-communicative as a result of dementia or some other severe neurological or psychiatric condition. And this term is used by a paper that came out, in fact, just today in this month's issue of Alzheimer's Dementia by a group of authors led by George Mashour at the University of Michigan. In addition, we have an accompanying commentary that was authored by myself and my colleagues here at the National Institute on Aging. And we're calling for more research on this phenomenon, because we think that there are several important outcomes that can result from understanding the phenomenon further. Our current models about dementia suggest that this is a relentless condition characterized by a progressive decline in function. But what paradoxical or terminal lucidity tells us is that dementia can be reversible, even briefly. And that would prompt us to ask the question, well, how? If we can answer that question, that might lead us to new insights about how people get dementia in the first place. And it might also lead us to develop new preventive or strategies or treatments for dementia.
How common is this phenomenon? How often does it happen?
That's a great question, and the answer is we just don't know. We have very little information about this phenomenon aside from the few case reports that have been reported in the scientific literature. These are reports that are made retrospectively, so after this episode happened, so we really don't have an accurate figure about how often it happens, and that's one of the main pieces of information that we'd like to determine through these research studies that we're hoping to support.
We're talking to Dr. Basil Eldada at the National Institute on Aging. We're looking at this phenomenon. It's being called paradoxical lucidity. Learning what it is, learning how scientists are approaching their research on it. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do you have a loved one with dementia who has experienced this moment of clarity? What happened? What was it like for you? And what questions do you have about dementia? Do you wonder about causes and genetics and treatments? Join in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Grace now, joining us from Platteville. Hi, Grace.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I was just calling in. My grandmother, she has dementia, and she just had a very very clear moment. My grandfather very recently passed away. And before that, she wasn't really aware of how unwell he was. But she knew was, and it was like, as he was going, she was able to be there for us.
Oh, wow. What was it like for you to experience that?
It was honestly, it was surreal. Cause a few days before, she didn't know if I was me or my sister. And then as he's passing, she turned to me. She said my name. She said, I know what's happening. And thanks for being here, kind of thing. And it was a lot.
Wow. How long of a time was it? I mean, time in that space is just certainly not the most relevant thing, but how long was that?
It was a few days where it was pretty consistent, and now she's kind of gone back to, she still knows he's gone, but she doesn't recognize everybody all the time anymore. So it's kind of seems like it's slipping again.
Grace, thank you so much for your story. Dr. Eldada, is that what you're talking about with what researchers are looking at?
Yes, exactly. And this is the kind of story that appears in the case reports in the literature, and also from people that we've spoken to who have seen this phenomenon. This is the kind of thing that we're interested in studying further. We just don't know how often this happens, and we also don't know what causes it, what are the factors that lead to it. Is there some way of predicting who might manifest these episodes of lucidity or not? And then your caller also talked about kind of the reactions to this phenomenon. There's a range of reactions from, you know, surprise, sometimes just not really knowing what to do with that that moment of
clarity. She called it surreal.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great term for it. We see a range of reactions in the discussions that we've had with people who have seen this this phenomenon. So your caller points to some really important characteristics and gaps in our knowledge that we need to fill with, and we're hoping to do some of that with these studies that we want to support.
So do scientists have any theories about what might be going on in the brain?
Again, this is an open question, and this is one of the main reasons why we wanted to support these studies, because if we understood what was going on in the brain in individuals who manifested these episodes of lucidity, then that might point to some novel insights into our understanding of how dementia happens. And if we knew that, then we might be able to figure out, you know, ways to prevent dementia or to treat it. But at this point, we really don't know. Everything is really just speculation.
And speculation as to what perhaps are any types of chemical changes going on in the body closer to death, because this seems to be happening in a more terminal setting when the patient is closer to death.
That seems to be the case. That's the impression you get from the current literature. What we don't know is whether this only happens shortly before death. It's possible that this return to lucidity may occur at a period of time farther away from death. We just don't know. And so some of the studies that we would like to support are prospective studies, that is, following a group of individuals who have dementia and then following them for a long period of time to understand when this lucidity, if it happens, when does it happen in relationship to death. I should mention that there is also some literature on end-of-life phenomena in general, this kind of sudden return of energy or activity that happens to people shortly before they die. Some people have called this the end-of-life rally. And it's possible that this paradoxical or terminal lucidity might be just one way in which that sudden return of energy displays itself.
We're talking with Dr. Basil Eldada in clinical gerontology at the National Institute on Aging, looking at these moments of lucidity with dementia patients. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring this emerging research on what's called paradoxical lucidity. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and paradoxical lucidity is this unexpected cognitive awareness and communication in patients with severe dementia, especially around the time of death. And this has been observed and reported anecdotally. Now, scientists are saying that if it's confirmed, that this would really challenge current assumptions about dementia and could potentially be a big breakthrough in neurobiology. Do you have a loved one with dementia who has experienced sudden moments of clarity? What was that like? Do you work with people who have dementia? What do you think people should understand about this work? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Dr. Basil Eldada oversees funding for aging research at the National Institute on Aging, and he stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Dennis joining us from Mountain. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I just want to mention my father had Alzheimer's, and a few days before he passed away, my sister went to go see him and brought her two children with him. And he always referred to her as my mother, didn't know that it was her daughter, and he didn't know who the kids were. But a few days before he passed away, it was like he was never sick. And he knew who she was. He knew who the little kids were, which were her kids. And, you know, he had this gloss over his eyes all the time he was sick like that. And all of a sudden, it was all cleared up and like he was never sick.
So even physically, Dennis, even physically, you could see a change in his eyes.
Right.
Wow.
Right. And he was sitting upright in a chair. At one time, he couldn't walk. He couldn't, you know, he really didn't sit up properly. They had to, like, strap him in a chair. But at that time, there was no problem with him. And it was just shocking, actually.
Dennis, thanks so much. Dr. Eldada, there were even physical changes. And as Dennis is saying, he could even sit up in a chair.
Yes, that's right. And we've heard that as well, that the manifestations of lucidity may not be limited to simply just meaningful speech. There may be many other manifestations as well, including, you know, physical activity. And that's one of the many kinds of characteristics that we'd like to understand associated with this condition. Your caller also suggests that, you know, this is something, this phenomenon, it may happen more often than we think. And I suspect that you may have other callers as well this morning who will report the same thing. And what it tells us is that this is probably a phenomenon that's under-recognized. It's transient. You know, individuals with dementia are often left without being observed for long periods of time. Sometimes they're given certain medications that can mask their behavior or speech. And sometimes individuals just may be reluctant to talk about what they've witnessed, because it sounds strange or they just don't want to seem unusual. But our hope is that by bringing more awareness to this phenomenon, more people will talk about it, will recognize it, and we'll just have that much more information to study.
Well, let's bring in Lori now in Mineral Point with a story. Hi, Lori.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, when my mother-in-law fell and cut her leg real bad at the care center, and she had dementia, when she was transported to the hospital, when we got there, she knew who we were. She knew what was going on. It was just a really strange phenomenon to see that, for her not to be very verbal anymore and all of a sudden to be very clear and know exactly who we were and what was going on. And it lasted about 2 or 3 days. And I wondered what was going on in the brain at that time that made her so clear in that particular moment.
And Lori, it sounds like the scientists are going to try to work on that. But after those 2 to 3 days, what happened after that?
Well, she was back at the care center and kind of fell into her normal routine and kind of went back into this dementia state where she kind of knew where things were and who was there, but not really. She kind of went right back to where she had been before the accident.
Lori, thanks so much. Dr. Eldada, what will the research look like on this? Since this is unpredictable, we have the anecdotes here and they pour in. How do researchers get their arms around that?
You point to a set of challenges that we expect with this kind of research. We don't think it's going to be easy, but we think that the potential payoff will be well worth the effort. The kinds of studies that we're interested in supporting are, you know, surveys of staff at nursing homes or caregivers and families who have witnessed these episodes, so we can get more information about the characteristics that went along with these episodes of lucidity, to get more information about what might have caused or what might be associated with the lucidity, and also what are the underlying medical conditions, some genetic factors, other aspects. We're also interested in supporting studies that will follow patients prospectively, and what would be really useful is to actually capture these episodes by audio or video recordings, maybe other types of monitoring, so we can find out in real time what was happening. That kind of information would be really useful. We're also interested in studying, you know, speech patterns of individuals who manifest lucidity. There are, you know, linguistic tools that can be used. There's also this set of studies focus on kind of the ethical challenges of that impact decision making, for example, when a family member witnesses a loved one have a moment of clarity. What do you do with that? All of these kinds of studies are the things that we'd like to support with this call for research funding.
We're talking with Dr. Basil Eldada at the National Institute on Aging, looking at lucidity, paradoxical lucidity, and this clarity that so many people have reported in dementia patients. Your story is as welcome as well at 800-642-1234. Mike joining us now from Antioch, Illinois. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What is your experience?
My dad died of dementia in 1994, but I think it was probably at least 10 months before he passed. I was working at a Milwaukee ad agency, and one of his attendants at the care facility he was at in Michigan called, and she said, "Michael, your father is lucid." So at that moment, they said it. When I got the call, I had to stop a few meetings, and I said, I don't understand what you mean by he's lucid. He's been not even cognitively communicating for over 2 years. And she said, he's lucid. His time and dates will be messed up. And she just said, when you speak to him, just don't cry. Don't get emotional, but he's going to remember you. So I spoke to my dad for 45 minutes, And he was disoriented. It was in January, and he was talking about the Detroit Tigers and calling this one pitcher, Mickey Lolich, a fathead because he always served up home run balls. And I thought, oh, yeah, he's always throwing that slow curve, and he gets knocked out of the park from Dad. And he goes, yeah, he was calling me Hot Dog. That was his pet name for me. And then he actually... this was what threw me. He says, why haven't you called? And I thought, that was a little bit different. And I didn't know if he was cognitively aware that I wasn't calling, because I had not.
No, wow.
There was zero communication. And so we spoke. It was a great conversation. And I said goodbye. And then I cried my eyes out after. And the next morning, about the same time, I called back to the facility in Michigan, and she said, "Michael, he's gone," and he never came back. But so when I was driving to work today, hearing this conversation, I think the doctor on so many levels is so smart about how he wants to go about this.
Thank you so much for the story, Dr. Eldada. Some closing thoughts here.
So, thank you for highlighting this this area of research. We're really excited to support this new area for which there really is very little data. And as your callers suggest, this manifests itself in lots of different ways, and probably more often than we think. You know, your caller points to a really important aspect of this phenomenon. You know, if a person in the end stages of dementia suddenly comes back, as it were, that really forces us to ask, well, where were they before? And then when that lucidity fades away, as it always seems to do, you know, we have to ask, well, where do they go? So, you know, these studies about lucidity can really help to inform our understanding about the very nature of personhood and consciousness in dementia. And, you know, and that's important because of the potential impact on families and caregivers.
Dr. Eldada, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Basil Eldada is a supervisory medical officer of the Division of Geriatrics and Clinical Gerontology at the National Institute on Aging. Coming up, the Trump administration announced this week that it would change the way the Endangered Species Act is applied. We'll talk about it. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at new rules coming out of the Trump administration and how the Endangered Species Act would be applied. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And this week, the administration finalized changes to enforcement. The rules are designed to improve transparency and effectiveness, but some critics say it will drive more animals to extinction. And at least 10 attorneys general have joined with conservation groups to protest an early draft of the changes. So what do you make of these changes to the Endangered Species Act? What questions do you have about the rules? We're at 800-642-1234. Lisa Friedman is a New York Times reporter who covers climate and environmental policy in Washington, and she's been reporting on the Trump administration changes to the Endangered Species Act. Lisa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So explain what the Trump administration is proposing here. What would change about this really landmark Endangered Species Act?
Sure. What the Trump administration announced on Monday are really some of the farthest reaching changes to the way the Endangered Species Act is enforced in its history. Some of the major changes are weakening protections for threatened species, which is a classification one step below endangered, making it harder to take climate change into account when thinking about how to protect species. And one of the more significant ones, I mean, they're all significant in a way, we can dig deeper into any one of these, but taking cost into account for the first time when deciding whether a species should be listed as endangered or not.
What do you mean by taking cost into account?
Yeah, so right now, the way the law is interpreted and reads, scientists can only consider one thing when they decide whether or not a species deserves protection from the government. Is it threatened? Just the science. It's a purely scientific decision. And the rule does an interesting thing and tries to thread a needle. It removes the language that insists that prohibits considering economic factors when deciding whether a species should be protected. The Trump administration has said, and Fish and Wildlife Service officials said on Monday, this will still be only a decision based on science, but it is now allowing economic determinations to be done and to be made public. Environmental groups are very concerned. Their argument is, look, if you're going to do the economic assessments, you're going to use them, whether the administration says they will or not. It will become a factor. And their argument is that these studies are important to know down the road. Of course, it's important to know if you if you create protections around a certain bird and that prevents logging or mining or drilling or development in an area, what is the economic cost, for example, of lost resource development? But their argument is that that study has no place in this original determination of, is this species in danger or not?
Well, Lisa, step back for us for a moment. What is the difference between an endangered species and threatened species, and how would the change impact each category?
Sure. So threatened is essentially a species that is likely to become endangered within the foreseeable future. And so the way the Endangered Species Act had been interpreted is that was that threatened species received all of the protections, blanket protections, that endangered species received. Under the new policy, the administration would create sort of individual plans for each species on a case-by-case basis. So what would that mean? For example, environmental groups say that there are species that are severely threatened by this. They point to the monarch butterfly, for example, which is struggling but hasn't yet been officially labeled endangered. And they are worried that that bird, that the monarch butterfly will not or might not receive the kinds of protections that it needs to continue to thrive. On the other side of the coin, farmers, ranchers, others who have been very critical of the Endangered Species Act have felt that the rules around threatened species were so stringent that it really made it created a disincentive for landowners, for example, to protect threatened species on their lands and stop them from becoming endangered. And they see this as a big win. They've called it a misguided approach that they believe actually hurts conservation efforts. And they think this will help. So, that's one of the big outstanding debates.
Right.
In
and,
this
and from an
measure.
Economic assessment, it could be that you would take into account lost revenue from not being able to do logging in a critical habitat area when deciding whether to decide a species warrants protection.
So, right. I mean, on the economic factors, you're exactly right. I mean, I would stress that the administration has maintained that the designation will remain science-based entirely. However, they're also saying we intend to do these studies. We haven't developed a system yet for how we'll do them, but it will be a separate process from the designation process. But we intend to do these studies and let the public know how much money they might be the country or a state might be losing in return for protecting a plant, bird, or animal, mammal species.
Like basically showing that transparency as here are the trade-offs economically.
That's exactly the way the administration described it, as a transparency measure.
We're talking with Lisa Friedman. She's a New York Times reporter who covers climate and environmental policy, and she's been covering the Trump administration changes to the Endangered Species Act rules coming out this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard about the new changes to the Endangered Species Act? What questions do you have about the new rules and how they would be applied? What Wisconsin wildlife species are you concerned about? Have you noticed changes in the natural world over the years? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So how are these new rules, this proposal, being considered against the backdrop of climate change and how it relates to endangered species?
Yeah, that's another very controversial change to this regulation. So the rules now give the government a lot of discretion in deciding what is meant by a certain term in the Endangered Species Act. Under the act, the government needs to protect species that are endangered in the face threats in the foreseeable future. Well, what is the foreseeable future? I mean, climate change has some really far-reaching implications when it comes to species habitat. And this rule would really narrow the way that that the government is allowed to think about foreseeable future. The Fish and Wildlife Service officials who described the changes to us said that, you know, the agency wants to avoid making what they call speculative decisions. And they kind of described this in terms not of climate change, but of development. Gary Fraser with the Fish and Wildlife Service spoke to reporters and, you know, used the example of building development. And he said, look, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, we might know zoning laws, we might have building plans, but if you're going to talk about what might be done or might not be done 70 or 80 years from now, that's a lot harder for us to predict. Scientists, however, and environmental groups say, look, it's not that difficult. We don't know the exact contours, but it is known that polar bears and seals are losing sea ice, that beluga whales are going to have to dive deeper and longer to find food, you know, and that the government should start to begin to plan for these changes, and find the fact that they're not and making it harder to do so very concerning.
So how might the changes impact things like mining and drilling and industries like fossil fuels?
You know, the general sense is that it is likely to make it easier. Certainly, you know, these changes were undertaken as part of President Trump's mandate to, you know, to rein in government regulation on corporations. And that includes on the oil and gas industry that want to seek resources on protected lands.
We're looking at rule changes to the Endangered Species Act with New York Times reporter Lisa Friedman as our guide, and she covers climate and environmental policy. You can join in. Are there species you think we've overprotected? How could they be managed differently? Join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of these rule changes to the Endangered Species Act? Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back for more discussion in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Endangered Species Act here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Trump administration finalized rules this week that aim to narrow the scope of the law, saying that it burdens landowners, that it hurts industry, and that it hinders economic growth. Critics are saying, on the other hand, it will drive more animals to extinction. So what do you make of the rule changes? What questions do you have about the Endangered Species Act and how it works? Do you support the changes? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Lisa Friedman reports on climate and environmental policy at the New York Times, and she stays with us. Let's bring in Karen now, joining us from Spooner. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I find this conversation disingenuous, considering this administration does not believe in scientific facts. How, if we're not going to protect all species from extinction, are we going to protect children from extinction? We're talking about a much wider range of issues here, and this is about big business rolling over the environment, and it's a danger and threat to all of us, not just endangered species, but humans as well.
Karen, thanks for the call. Lisa, a number of Democratic lawmakers around the country have been pretty vocal in their opposition to the rule changes. What do we know about the pressure, the challenges, and the legal challenges in particular?
Sure. So this faces challenges from two ends, the states and from Democrats in Congress. In Congress, you know, the ability to do something about this is limited because of the makeup. Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico, he suggested that that lawmakers might use a 1996 law called the I'm blanking on the Congressional Review Act, right? That could hinder the ability of the administration to move forward with this regulation, you know. But Republicans control the Senate, and it's not really clear that this will be able to happen. Though he and other Democrats said that they are looking for this and other legislative measures.
Do you expect a lot of litigation to come out of this?
Yes, absolutely. So as you mentioned earlier, 10 states led by California, Massachusetts, others, New York have said that they intend to sue. Javier Becerra, the attorney general of California, you know, he described this. He said, you know, this isn't just nibbling around the edges of the Endangered Species Act, as, you know, the administration's contention is that this is merely clarifying and streamlining some laws. But, you know, he argued that this is a wholesale change that will make it harder to protect species. And states are getting ready to file legal challenges, as I'm sure are environmental groups.
We're talking with Lisa Friedman from the New York Times. She covers climate and environmental policy. She's been covering the Trump administration changes to the Endangered Species Act. Lisa, Kayla from Eau Claire called but couldn't stay with us. And Kayla says transparency is important in these decisions. But Kayla says, how can we weigh the advantages of economic development against the price of losing species? How do those things even compare?
I mean, that question really gets right to the heart, I think, of whether or not to introduce cost factors into this process. You know, again, when listing a species as endangered or threatened, there is a lot of things go into that, including, you know, the cost consideration. But at the moment of deciding whether a species is threatened, you know, there's a very strong argument that groups are making that is something that should really purely be a decision of science.
So what power do the congressional leaders who oppose these changes, what power do they have to challenge them?
Well, let's take a step back for a moment, because, you know, Republicans in Congress have sought to narrow the Endangered Species Act for decades. And over the past 2 years, you know, there have been a number of bills. There was a huge legislative push to overhaul this law. And this moved in the House, the Senate never took it up. Well, now with Democrats in control of the House, there's little chance of those measures passing. So that's one dynamic. Then there's the question you posed of what will Democrats do to fight these regulatory changes? You know, and that is really unclear, I think, at this point. You know, there's going to be bills introduced. There's certainly going to be a lot of oversight in the House, where Democrats control where Democrats are in control. But in the Senate, they're, you know, Republicans are broadly in favor of this. John Barrasso, the chairman of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, applauded these moves. I think it will be, you know, very difficult for a challenge to move forward legislatively.
Well, you take a step back there. Let's go way back to 1973. What was the impetus behind the idea for this Endangered Species Act when it was signed into law?
So as you said, this was signed in 1973 by Richard Nixon, and the government was, you know, Nixon became a really unlikely champion, I think, of endangered species. You know, he, you know, I read that he was quite not the environmental activist in private, and expressed a lot of concern with environmentalists. But I think he also recognized that this sort of sweeping legislation to protect species was going to be a critical one.
So are there instances where the Endangered Species Act has been overused, too constraining? You know, here in the Midwest, some Midwesterners think it's been in, you know, that is the case in with the gray wolf, for instance.
Absolutely. I mean, I've spoken to farmers and ranchers who, you know, really said, look, this has been used more as a political tool than an environmental tool. And I think, you know, all over the country, you find private property owners, not just, you know, not just drillers and miners and, you know, but people who own land who say that they have been negatively affected by endangered species laws, that they are too stringent. They haven't. And they also argue that the law hasn't worked. I mean, over the course of the life of the Endangered Species Act, only about 3% of the species listed as threatened or endangered have been removed. You know, now environmental groups will argue that this law has protected a tremendous number of species, you know, from the grizzly bear to the American alligator. But it is also true that getting a species off the list has been inordinately difficult.
In the last few seconds, what is the timeline here for these rule changes? What happens next?
So these will go into effect in approximately 30 days. It's tied to when something is officially entered into the Federal Register. And then groups will have about 60 legislative days to file a lawsuit. So over the next couple months, you'll start seeing lawsuits, and, you know, it will really, I think, come down to the courts to decide whether these changes will stand up.
Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lisa Friedman is a New York Times reporter who covers climate and environmental policy. She's been reporting on the Endangered Species Act changes. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.